where she didn't jump. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 17, 2022. Let the record reflect the time is currently 9 minutes past the 15:39. Late start today. Got some technical issues. We're going to have a, hopefully, kind of an interesting guest here in a little while from Ireland to the committee. So that's where our slowdown is. We'll see how it goes. Today we have President Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Hall, and myself, Chair Schauer. Please turn off your cell phones or silence those. We've got staff assisting us and rest from my office, Carrie from Senate Records, and Alex with the LAO. We do have five bills on the agenda today. For the sake of time, just going to read the highlight numbers, House Bill 187, then Senate Bill 207, Senate Bill 214, Senate Bill 129, House Bill 123. We're going to keep moving. On to the scheduled bills. First one we're going to have up today is going to be House Bill 187. By Representative Kaufman. Representative Kaufman's staff, if you want to come up to the table, put yourself on the record and present the bill, please.
Thank you. For the record, Representative James Kaufman, South Anchorage, on down turning an arm to Girdwood. I want to thank the committee chair and the committee for hearing HB 187 today. The concept for this bill came about in our continuing search for operational cost reductions, how we can improve the efficiency of government. And the opportunity here is to reduce costs by preventing the creation of documents or publishing them or printing them if they're not really required anymore. In order to do this, we've created a process where an existing list of publications are available, and it simply creates a biannual review process to look at that list of publications and to decide if they are no longer needed. What that results in is a bill that is produced by the executive branch, sent over to the legislature to propose that these documents can be consolidated or we can put them online. We don't need to keep doing what we've been doing. Institutionally, what happens is things get created, requirements get created for publications, but they may not really be necessary after time, or we may be able to deliver them online, consolidate two, three documents into an online presentation. In a previous concept that didn't make it through the legislature, it was estimated, I think that was 7 years ago, that you could save about $600,000 a year. Now, the scope of that concept was a little smaller than what we're doing. It was simply to quit printing certain documents, but this actually gets more at the root cause of, do we still need to keep creating these publications, or could we modify our statutes and just quit doing it altogether or consolidate them as I described earlier. So all told, if you think of the life cycle of a document, people spend a lot of time creating it, then it's transported, it may be printed, it may be transported again. Ultimately, it ends up in a landfill somewhere, so if printed. So there's a lot of opportunity for reduction and savings in all of this. So all told, time, energy, space, and lots of money and effort can be saved by the passage of HB 187. Thank you.
We'll open up to questions first for the sponsor initially. Anyone from the committee? Senator Costello.
Thank you. I appreciate the sponsor bringing this bill forward. I voted for that legislation, and so I read this and I thought, aren't we doing this anyway? And I appreciate that we're looking at ways to save paper, and these documents sometimes do just sit on a shelf. Is the idea behind looking at anything that's outdated, duplicative, or excessive so that we could come in and remove that requirement and statute? Because oftentimes in, you know, the bill process, we actually want to know what's happening and what the response has been to a particular legislation. Is that the idea, that then there would be more bills that would be generated that would remove the requirement, perhaps?
Through the chair, Senator Costello. Yeah, what it would be, it's a feedback loop. So it creates the review process. So, well, maybe we can consolidate this and this together, and we don't need to. Maybe we can put it online, we don't need to publish it. And that shows up in the form of a legislative proposal coming from the executive branch. So then you have legislative input into that. So it's not where somebody is just going to quit doing something. But what will be looked at is what needs to be changed statutorily in order to affect that proposed change.
Paula? Right. And when this list is created, was there any thought put into perhaps making it a hot link so that when you're reviewing the list of the report, you don't have to just say, oh, there's this report, and then go find it in order to determine, you know, if it's something that we still want to have, you know, provided to us.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Senator Costello, we don't have that explicit requirement in here, but that would be a good delivery mechanism.
Senator Kawasaki, I think you had a question.
Yeah, just thank you for presenting this, Representative. Just a question on, I guess I kind of got it clarified by the question from Representative Costello. It's that the legislature would get a list, but the legislature could say that we still want to get that and not introduce a bill to repeal the basically the requirement that requires that something be published quarterly and sent to the legislators. Is that correct?
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. Correct. It uses legislative processes to change what may have been legislated, and thus creating the requirement.
And then through the chair, you know, some of these reports, you have a table of reports from legislative legal in the packet. Some of these reports are very important, and I would hate to see a legislature decide that we as legislators don't need to see it, or the public may be carved out of the process, because again, a lot of these reports are fairly important, I think, for the public to receive. I mean, what are the guarantees that the public will have a chance to speak for or against, you know, I guess a bill saying that we no longer have to publish a particular report on, you know, vaccination rates and vaccination assessments or something like that that's listed in the reports.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. The concept would be, first off, it would have to make it through the entire legislative process. So you would have hearings, you would have public engagement, you'd have all the normal tools and precautions that we have. But the other thing is that it would not necessarily be just elimination of a report. The proposal may be that we've looked through all of this and we can consolidate this and that and produce and deliver it perhaps online or by some other means. So it's not a binary question. It's more of a qualitative question of how can we do things better if we were to create this two-year review cycle and consider improving what we do.
And just finally, I suspect that if this bill were to pass, probably what would happen is you'd see an omnibus bill with a bunch of different sections laying out either that these statutorily required agency reports would be all compiled in one, you know, one bill basically, and then members would either say, no, this is way too important to just have online. We need to have a hard copy sent to libraries and state archives and things like that. I guess that's just a statement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I do have a question for you. So there's quite a few changes as you look through the process and the other body. So as the sponsor to the bill, are you comfortable with where it is? Were there things that were changed from your original intent that you would like to see re-added? So as the process has played out, are you comfortable that the bill is in a form that accomplishes what you set out to as far as your goals?
Absolutely. I'm sorry. To the chair.
Okay.
Absolutely. It was actually a beneficial process of what we did over in state affairs. And so we're very happy with the results of that. We feel we have a better bill out of it.
Okay. If there's no further questions, go ahead, Senator Costello.
Thank you. Just looking at the language of the bill, it looks like each state agency will compile the list. So you've got 14, 15 agencies. Is there any way that we could just have it, you know, compiled and then provided to us in one list rather than a list for every single agency?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair to Senator Costello. What we're working with is the existing construct to avoid changing things that, and so the existing requirement right now is that the agencies keep lists of what they're producing. So that exists, but that could be compiled. There's nothing to prevent that from being compiled, and I imagine that's how it would be delivered as a compilation.
Thank you.
Other committee members? Moment. Okay, then we'll go to, I believe, section analysis and anything else you'd like your staff to brief on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Representative Kaufman. and just a really brief sectional analysis. Section 1 amends AS37.07.020 to add a requirement for the governor to submit legislation to remove or amend statutory requirements for publications deemed to be outdated, duplicative, or excessive, or that could be consolidated with other publications, and which of those could be delivered in electronic form as directed in Section 2. Section 2 repeals and reenacts AS44.99.220, requiring state agencies to use a list of publications, which is already statutorily required to be developed, to identify and highlight publications deemed to be outdated, duplicative, or excessive, or that could be consolidated with other publications, or which could be delivered in an electronic form. The list of publications, including the highlighted publications, is required to be electronically submitted to the governor and both bodies of the legislature, and Section 3 provides for an immediate effective date.
Okay, questions in committee? And I usually ask this just as a first-time brief, anything on a fiscal note?
The fiscal note we received from the Office of Management and Budget states that the work can be absorbed. So it's a zero fiscal note. The Office of Management and Budget will accommodate the additional workload with existing resources. The process that the Office of Management and Budget has testified to previously is that when they send guidance to agencies for creation of the budget, they would also send the guidance that includes a little statement about this list of publications. And then with receipt of budget requests and information from agencies to the Office of Management and Budget, there would be included the highlighted list of publications, and OMB would compile, consolidate, and submit that with the budget request to the governor.
Very good, Matt. Thank you. So questions for staff? Senator Kawasaki.
Yep, just a comment on the immediate effective date. If it's an immediate effective date, it means that the governor currently would have to start compiling this information, and then a future governor or the current governor would have to comply with it December 15th, which is when the budget's released. Is that correct, then, how I read it?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, yes, the act would take effect immediately if with the immediate effective date. The existing AS44.99.220, which is being repealed and reenacted, states that state agencies shall compile and maintain a list of publications. The assumption is that they should be compiling and maintaining this list, so really it would be going through and highlighting during the budget process for the next cycle. And then the bill is submitted at the beginning of each new legislature. That was the biennial change that was made in House State Affairs, and that way it doesn't get mixed up because the bill can carry through to the next year of the legislature.
Thank you. Representative, go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to comment on that through the chair. The concept we employed with this was a light touch. How do you take work that's already being done, existing lists, and add the feature of a feedback loop that creates an opportunity to find cost reductions where possible? So that's why we leverage the requirement that lists are being maintained. The assumption that if people are producing documents or publications, they know what they have to produce, so they have a list of what they do, and it just creates that feedback loop to go back through it.
Thank you. Very good. Other questions, comments from committee members? Senator, we'll go Senator Reinbold first, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to. Well, in Senator Kawasaki's, the even year, that would be this year, obviously, 2022. And so where I was going with this, it looks like the legislature would then vote on it, if it's my understanding, because they would compile a list of publications, and then the legislature would decide if those are needed or unneeded. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, correct. The idea is to keep the legislature engaged since, as pointed out previously, these reports may have value. You don't want this to become an opportunity for the executive branch to just simply quit doing needed work. And there's also the consideration that much of it is statutorily required. So it just keeps the legislature engaged in the assessment of whether or not these are valid reductions or perhaps they're overreach.
My follow-up?
Go ahead.
And the follow-up would be, well, you know how we agree and disagree in this building. Maybe one legislature would want it and the next one wouldn't. And so what I'm wondering is if the legislature deleted a whole bunch of them, let's say it was a repeal legislature, you know, then would that, would those things still be on the list, or would they be gone? I mean, are you technically repealing statutes, or are you just saying this year I don't need that report?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. No, that if it's statutorily required, is then statutes would have to be changed in order to make that change. So you would have to engage the legislative process to affect the change. You would not be saying, well, we'll ignore statute this time around. And then as to if you get into a future state, so we've gone through a cycle of this and some publications have been consolidated. Maybe they were being printed and now they're online, or they were two separate publications and that they've been merged into one, which will save mailing costs or whatever if they're printed. And that so after a cycle of this, you're in that cycle. If there's a report that's required, then people would have to identify that, hey, we need this report, and go back after it. But you would assume if due diligence was done during the legislative cycle that omitted the requirement for that would not happen, or at least it wouldn't be a big risk. I mean, it could happen, but I don't think it's enough to overlook the possibility of the cost reduction, you know, that drives the proposed legislation.
Senator Costello.
Thank you. So the language says the governor shall submit legislation to consolidate or eliminate, and so that means that the governor must, which means that if this became law, you're assuming that there are things to be eliminated, and so every 2 years you'll have more reports that you have to have a bill that makes a recommendation. So I was just curious what you know, why it doesn't say may. And then the other question I have to do, it has to do with the balance of power. So the legislature writes the bills that say we would like a report, we would like to know, you know, the outcome of what this bill might do. We just had a bill in this committee, in this room, you know, a few hours ago, where we are asking for a report. Why the executive branch? I mean, they're the branch of government that's tasked with doing the reports by the legislature. So then now the governor would say, well, we don't really want this report, so we're going to put that in the bill that goes to the legislature. Is there another way to do it so that it's the legislative branch that's actually in, you know, more driving the bus than the governor's office?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Costello. The idea is that the people at the work front, in quality management processes, you try to get the input of the people that are right on the bleeding edge, so to speak, of providing a service, because they often know, for instance, my favorite movie Office Space, which, they're always joking about the TPS reports, and it took a real act of Congress to quit having to produce the TPS reports. They brought in efficiency experts, et cetera, and in the end, the place burned down to the ground, but that hate to spoil the movie. So what you need is you need the input of the people that are doing the work, and that's the idea here, that the people doing the work will know that, hey, we can do this better, more efficiently this way, and send that recommendation up through the line. The safeguard in all that is that you still have the review by the legislature saying, oh, heck no, you're not going to quit doing that. Or they may say, yeah, it makes sense to do that online because that's the best delivery of that content. And printing these things and sending them everywhere isn't a good value any longer. It's maybe a better way to deliver what's being proposed. So it's really just to create that feedback loop. But it's not to let anybody off the hook in terms of having a good solid review. When that bill comes in biannually, it may not have a lot of recommendations on it if we've gotten to a point where at lean operations and everything's already been done. But the way that requirements tend to pile on year after year and accrue, there's, I suspect, a lot of low-hanging fruit here, as we've seen with the other estimate of $600,000 a year. I suspect we're talking about more. But we start to trim back rather than continually accrue. We'll get to the point where we have the information delivered in maybe a much more consumable way, because it will be a leaner document base.
Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Just a
just a really quick comment. The report that's produced by Legislative Legal Services actually provides a list of all of the statutory required agency reports. And they identified 189. They felt, they believe their research is thorough, is what they are quoted as saying in here. I mean, that's one way that we can actually look at it and approach at it from our legislative branch to the to direct the executive branch, rather than the executive branch saying, we don't need to do this report, the legislature doesn't need to see it anymore, so we're going to put it in this list of bills, or the list with the bill to basically end it. I guess I sort of have some of the similar concerns that Senator Costello has. Thanks.
Beth, go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, the language in the bill says the governor shall, and that is, I guess, it can be read as kind of intent language, because we can't necessarily require the governor to submit a bill, but having it in there is the legislative intent behind that. But it also says the governor shall submit that bill based on the highlighted list, and if they don't highlight any, then he may not have to submit that bill. And then there's also the requirement for that list to be submitted to the legislature and the public. And through the submittal of that, that can be backup information to add or remove highlighted publications from that bill that the governor submits. Kind of give the legislature all the information they need to make their own decisions, but to have the bill be referred to a committee a little bit more powerful than to have the report issued to the legislature and leave it to them to write the bill through Ledge Legal and go through the drafting process.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator, and I'll just say to that, obviously there will be a chance to amend. If there are concerns from committee members that you might want to see it differently, I would encourage you to work with the sponsor and see if there's an amendment that would assuage those concerns, and everybody will have that opportunity. Senator Ramble?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to color too far out of the lines, but I really do agree with Senator Kawasaki and Senator Costello. I think this is a legislative issue. And I think, you know, we could put the governor in, you know, working with the legislature, or the legislature needs to do this. But I am so tired of executive branch overreach right now. I just kind of had it. So I really want to, I don't want him telling us that we don't need reports and they don't want to do it. So if I was a governor, you know, maybe I wouldn't want to put all this work into all of this. But then all of a sudden, one of y'all have a bill and I need that report that I didn't think I needed. You know, because we never know what issue. So I save a whole bunch of these reports because I never know what is all on the hearts of the senators that I'm going to have to be dealing with. So I just think it's important. I would have loved to have Admin Reg Review and have this assigned to Admin Reg Review, but sadly the legislature got rid of that super important committee, in my opinion. I would put the Admin Reg Review with the nullification of federal laws, with a review like a repealer of reports or even legislation, but I think it needs to belong housed somewhere with a stamp of approval. I do know we have to end up voting on it, but even though I love the concept, I definitely think I know I need to process who's responsible for this.
Response?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. There's a couple things that are really important. One is that you get the voice of the people that are doing the work, and I don't mean the governor by that. I mean down in the agencies, the people that are actually compiling these reports and maybe know a better way that they can, you know, deliver the same or similar content, or that the content is, you know, in some lines of work, we've done reports where nobody ever asks us about any of the information that's put out there. And you start to wonder over time, what does this report do? Is it really needed? And so it would be good to get the voice of the people at the front lines of preparing all these reports and putting all this documentation together. If they know of a better way, and this creates that feedback opportunity. So you almost look at it like not the executive branch, the governor, but the executive branch, all the workers that are there, of that input coming up, filtering through the governor, coming over for review and approval in the legislature. So the opportunities for overreach are only enabled by the extent that the legislature would not give it a good look and not do due diligence in deciding, you know, whether or not to go with a proposal or to amend it. There's always that process too. And then there's the public engagement process of committee hearings and with all that. So there's lots of safeguards against the overreach aspect that you're concerned with.
One final.
You have a follow-up first? Okay. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, just one final is that, you know, these statutorily required reports by state agencies aren't just for us. They're for other people. People look at these things. I know that the Board of Education Early Development, for one, in statute in Title 14, presents it to the legislature an annual report describing the activities of the Borough Board to improve public education system. I know that our school district looks at those reports, too. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, any time that we're thinking or the governor might be thinking about ending a report, that there's that it's not just us that read those reports. And it's sometimes, you know, I might not read the report sometimes, but somebody is reading those reports. And I want to make sure that those folks are covered when it comes to this bill. For me, it's an issue of transparency. And I just want to make sure that folks will know that they're not going to get a copy of the report either if that's going to be what happens, or it's going to be consolidated into a different report. Thanks.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, or delivered in a different format. So this is not about cutting. It's really about optimizing. And in that optimizing process, that's where all the safeguards of the review, you have the constituent input in the committee hearing request. And I believe that if there's a document that people really care about, we'll hear about it in the, you know, we certainly hear from constituent groups all the time about things that they're wanting to keep or things they want us to do. So I think that process provides a good level of safeguard against reduction or loss of something that has a high value.
Okay. So I will tell you this, I do appreciate, as you well know, efficiency, and government has a well-deserved reputation for being one of the least efficient institutions on the planet. So the fact that you're just trying to do this and work for a way that would do even a small part of it, I think is well received is the actual word I was looking for. So I appreciate this one. If you have no further wrap-up comments this time.
Just to say thank you to everybody for hearing it. I appreciate the committee giving us time. I know it's a busy time right now. And if you have any questions, we're happy to meet, you know, offline and talk about some of these things or any other ideas that folks may have. Thank you very much.
So like I said, all committee members have a chance to work with the sponsor of this one. We're going to set this bill aside. If there are amendments, if you could please get them to the office by next week, Monday the 21st, and then we'll plan on bringing this bill back up with public testimony and any other invited at a future date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, this time we're going to move on to the next bill for the day. It's going to be Senate Bill 207. I'm going to ask my staff, Mr. Scott Ogan, to come to the table, and I will stay up here on the dice for this presentation. So I'll retain the gavel. What's that? Hold on. Okay, so at this time we're going to go with Senate Bill 207. I'm going to go ahead and present from here at the table, and I'll take the questions. I have introduced this bill working with a member from the other body as well as another senator for several years now, and I will just go through the introduction and then answer questions for it. Senate Bill 207 would make confidential records of individuals who have been convicted of minor marijuana crimes and were not charged with any other crimes in the same incident. These records would automatically be removed from court view. The records would also be removed from some background checks administered by the Department of Public Safety if requested by the convicted individual. In 2014, Alaska has voted to legalize the cultivation, sale, and possession of marijuana for those 21 years or older. Despite the change in the state law, some Alaskans remain blocked from employment and housing due to previous marijuana possession convictions that would not be a crime today. According to a report prepared by Legislative Research, there are more than 700 Alaskans convicted of low-level marijuana crimes between 2007 and 2017. Those convictions can make obtaining housing and gainful employment challenging. Now that voters have legalized marijuana, this legislation would allow those previously convicted to move on with their lives while ensuring those criminal and the criminal justice fields to have access to appropriate background information. I'll make it very clear I did not vote for that change to the law. I'm not particularly a fan of it, but I will say the reason I worked with the original sponsor of this bill and agreed to carry it is because if you look at the broadest sense of this, I wanted to make sure that, one, this was only that marijuana, nothing else. There was no
possession limits where somebody might have been selling it. No other types of drugs included in this. No criminal other backgrounds involved with that. No felons or felonies, etc. So to be very, very clear on this going through, this is only for that very limited number of Alaskans that today, had they been dealing with law enforcement and had that amount of possession or less on their body, they would not be charged with a crime today. And because of the fact that we want every single person, and we know our recidivism rates are high, to be back in the workforce and being productive citizens, this will allow those individuals to hopefully get better jobs, housing, et cetera, and get them back in the market. We know that every time when people come out of jail and they have issues, they have a 90% chance of being back to jail within X number of years because it's hard for them to reintegrate. And when you take away somebody's ability that was not a violent criminal, that didn't have any other felonies in their record, was not selling drugs, et cetera, it makes it very difficult for them to reintegrate in society. So for that reason, I've agreed to this because I do think this is a wise step to move forward on this particular one. But like I said, I just wanted to be clear for the committee members and the public that we were very specific on the criteria and asked for changes, and those changes were made to make this very, very tightly drawn to where it is today. So that being said, that's the introduction to the bill. I'll open it up to the committee members for questions. It's very simple, but we'll go through that, and then if we have any first. Anyone? Sarah Costello.
Thank you. Is there a definition of low-level crimes? And I also am curious about how an individual is dealt with when they sell to minors.
So if this be, yes, I don't know how you would define low-level crimes, but we do have Nancy on the record here for answering questions. So I may ask the courts if she could say, would that be one you could answer? Yes, no? No, I know. I want to see her before she goes. Sometimes she goes, no, I can't do it. Is that question, could you come on up, Nancy? We'll just put you up. And if you can't, that's fine. While we're doing that, I'll answer the second question. Just to be clear, if they were selling, it's irrelevant because that does not, they're not included here. So if they were selling anything or to minors, they would, this bill wouldn't apply.
Thank you. And my question wasn't whether it applied in this bill. I'd like to know actually what the crime is, selling to minors, and I'm sure somebody in the executive branch knows that.
They do. I apologize, Senator Costello. I thought you were asking if the bill applied to it. So, no, it doesn't, so I'm not prepared to answer that, but perhaps the court could if she could.
Through the chair, Nancy Mead for the court system. I was going to say that the term low-level crimes isn't included in this bill, so you recognize that, Senator. And so that your question about selling to minors would be better addressed to the executive branch.
Okay, thank you. Well, just while we got her, any other questions that might apply to the courts before we let her go and call her back? Okay, thanks, Nancy, for coming up. We don't have them on the line, but we'll bring them on for the next one to answer that question, so we'll make sure that one comes up because obviously we'll have to hear the bill again. Other questions from committee members at this time? Senator Kawasaki.
I don't know who to direct this question to, but maybe somebody in law. If a person, so it says if they're not convicted of any other criminal charges in that case, what if a person, I mean, typically when there's like, say, an assault charge or something like that, there's always two or three other cases or two or three other charges that follow, and sometimes they drop some of the charges in a plea. So I'm just curious if, is that typical? Is it not typical? Atypical?
I didn't even have to ask. She already came back up on the courts.
Thank you for the record again, Nancy Mead for the court system. Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, that issue has been discussed previously in this bill and other bills related to this bill. This was very carefully drafted to say that they weren't convicted of any other charges in the case. This does not, all we will look at is their final conviction in that case. We are not looking at whether they were charged with four counts of something and it was pled down to this. All this says is if they were convicted of that. You are correct that many cases are resolved through a plea bargain, and there may be some of the cases that would end up with a conviction just for possession of under an ounce of marijuana by an adult where the person was charged with something else and it ended up there. However, the wording of this bill would just cover those. That wouldn't matter. So it does not matter under this bill if the person was charged with other things. This is just looking at the final conviction in the case.
So to clarify, so if a person was charged with a misdemeanor assault charge and possession at the same time, the misdemeanor assault charge goes away, they are convicted of possession of less than 1 ounce of a Schedule 6A, then they would qualify for essentially sealed records.
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, yes and no. Yes, they would qualify under this bill to have their case removed from court view. Section 4 of the bill applies to court view only. The other sections of the bill apply to the Department of Public Safety. I do want to clarify this does not seal their records. It doesn't hide their records. Under Section 4, all it does is have the court take them off court view. A person could still, because the preference for court records is to have them open and transparent. Sorry. A person could still access those records at the courthouse, so they are not hidden other than taken off court view.
And to be clear on that, just to go as we circle the loop on this one, that was the intent, is that it can still be searched. So this is more for background checks for people that want to get, they need a job, housing, other things where you might have that, but to allow that to be searched, to not prevent it. And so I don't think that their other record, if they had the misdemeanor charge or some other type of charge, that's still going to show. That wouldn't apply here. So while the marijuana charge would be not on court view, the rest of it would still be there. Correct?
To the chair, the whole case would be off court view if that's the only conviction. But a person could go to the courthouse. We have kiosks that include what we call the unpublished cases. That is, there's the court view you access from your kitchen, and this would be off of there. But there is the court view expanded that you can access from the courthouse. You would then see that case, and you would see the progression of that case. For example, the number of charges, whether it was amended, dismissed, and everything that happened in that case. That's how Section 4 works from the court's point of view.
Does that make sense? Yeah. So, and I want to be clear, like I said, on the intent on this, Nancy, if you stay just for a minute, just in case.
I'm happy to stay.
That the intent here is to make sure that when somebody has marijuana only, that today would not be a crime, that they have the ability to get a job and get back into society. So if this was to apply to something else, that would not, and it did originally years ago. That's why we asked for the changes, and that's where we sit on this today. So if there is something that doesn't meet that intent, we certainly would like to look at that. And there is a companion that is moving through the other body, so we want to make sure that they're going to be reconcilable as well if we're able to do that. So if the committee members see something that doesn't make sense or there is a discrepancy, I'd like to fix that now as we go through that. Okay? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, is it limited to 21 years and older, because are there no possession crimes for under 21?
I'm sorry, through the chair to Senator Holland, there are indeed possession crimes for people under 21, because before February of 2015, all possession of under an ounce of marijuana was a B misdemeanor. If I can speak to the intent, as I understand it from working on this bill for several years, the intent is to shield, take off court view, those records of those people whose conduct would be legal today. The only thing that was legalized in the voter initiative was possession of under an ounce or six plants by those over 21. And so that is the choice that is made in version B of this bill, is to talk specifically to that conduct that the voters of Alaska decided should not be criminalized. And so this would retroactively hide those to that extent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I meant to thank you for that, because I know we had talked about this over the years. This has been a several-year process, so I'm just agreeing to move it at this point, but I think it meets the intent. Other questions from committee members at this time? Okay. Thanks, Nancy. All right. Let's see. I can go through the sectional briefly for that for folks, and then the fiscal policy or the fiscal analysis for us. So from the sectional analysis point of view, on the version we're working on, is Section 1 would add a new section stating the legislative intent behind the bill. Section 2 amends subsection B8 of AS 1262-160 by adding criminal justice information for marijuana possession that meet the requirements laid out in F of this section to the list of exceptions for the release of criminal justice information. Section 3 adds a new subsection F to AS 1262-160, which adds new criteria for criminal justice information that an agency cannot release. This new section prohibits release of criminal justice information for convictions under AS 1171060 for less than 1 ounce of Schedule 6A controlled substance where the defendant was 21 years or older at the time of the offense, was not convicted of any other criminal charges in that same case, and has formally requested that the agency not release these records. Section 4. As a new section, AS 2235, stating the records of criminal charges or convictions that meet the requirements stated in the section may not be published by the court system on a publicly available website. This applies to criminal justice information for convictions under AS 1171060 for less than 1 ounce of the Schedule 6A controlled substance, where the defendant was 21 years or older at the time of the offense and was not convicted of any other criminal charges in that same case. Section 5. As a new section to the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, saying the Alaska court system shall remove court records that meet requirements of this bill, retroactively going back from the effective date of the bill. It also uses the language to the extent practicable to clarify that the court system will not be legally required to expend excessive resources or funds to ensure every single record that meets the requirements of this bill for removal from court view is removed. Section 6 provides an effective date of 1 January 2023. Onto the fiscal note, there is a small fiscal note associated with this moving forward until the work is done. I won't spend a lot of time going into it on the back, but there was just some changes that they have to meet to go through the initial program, roughly about $184,000 projected, and then $121,000 in fiscal 24, but people can read the back of it without going into detail. And I'll leave it that again for further questions from committee members at this time. Okay. With that being said, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. If anybody has amendments, please get them to our office by Monday the 21st by close of business next week. We'll bring the bill back up. I apologize. I'm going off my script here on this one, and I did this to myself, so I'm going to open up public testimony at this time, because I meant to do that, and I forgot. So, that time we're going to open up public testimony. Do we have anybody in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Nope. Seeing and hearing none, we're going to move to online. I did not see anyone testify before the bill, so we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. My apologies for that. Almost skipped right past it. And that's the extent of our testimony today. So, like I said, we have amendments due next week, and we'll bring the bill back up at a future date. We're going to move on to the next bill. It's going to be Senate Bill 214 from Senator Reinbold's office. Are you going to stay here or go to the table?
Okay.
That's absolutely fine.
Awesome.
Okay, do you have staff just going to come up as well?
It would be great if my chief of staff, Kelly Toth, could come up.
Okay, when Kelly's up here, Senator Reinbold, go ahead and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation on Senate Bill 214, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. SB 214 is an act relating to civil liability for censorship of speech by a social media platform. And as you all know, this is a new area of law. And I'm just going to make a statement in regards to platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, etc. A lot of them have been extraordinarily political, and yet they are not held to standard of like APOC or having any type of regulation or any type of issues in regards to if they are promoting all one side versus the other, where they become very political. They're not being held to a political organization. So many of us have been targeted for example, if we have a position on the COVID-19 vaccine. We have been restricted. We have been, some of people have been deplatformed. Some have been shadow banned. Some have been said misinformation. And, in reality, it's not misinformation. It's information that they do not want to hear. So it is not a free place to basically post, et cetera. Often, what the owners of the platform are doing is they're very much, agenda driven and in some cases potentially even propaganda. And the issue here is that they fact check, and then when they testified before Congress, there was a hearing about this, and they were asking about the fact checking, and in reality what they said is, no, it's not fact checking, it's opinion checking. So this is a very, very serious issue that many of us, I can tell you my account is under deep restrictions right now. I believe it's been under deep restrictions since September. So that's the reason it really is all part of cancel culture. That's what the issue is. And that's why I know that this is a new issue of a new area of law. There's not a whole lot of case law. And that's why I just wanted to bring this as a discussion. And Mr. Chairman, before you give me permission to go through the sectional, I did want to make sure that the people
that you all were aware I did get a legal memo on this, and I'd like to point. I do have three lifelines, Noah Klein with Ledge Legal. I do have invited testimony, Cameron with the Heartland Institute, and I also have my staff, Kelly Toth, here. But I did think it was a right thing to do to go over the legal memo before I proceeded into the sectional. Mr. Chairman, is that all right?
Let's open it up for questions first, just in case. If committee members have questions so far, comments? Okay, that being said, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to read this. This is a memo I got on February 17th, 2022. And it basically said that the draft bill that you requested, please consider the following. First Amendment issues. Please be aware that the draft bill raises issues under the United States Constitution First Amendment, Article 1, Section 5 of the Alaska Constitution. Because social media websites are private entities, they are not government actors, they are entitled to freedom of speech protections. Government regulation of social media's website speech is therefore held to the same standard as government regulation of a private individual speech. So there's an issue here potentially with the bill for regulating private platforms, you know, how we regulate private platforms. So there's an issue on two sides of this. That's the first issue they brought up. Another issue that they brought up is damages, that in the bill requested that an injured party had $75,000 statutory damages, or actual damages, punitive damages, et cetera. And I'll get in that in the sectional. But I wanted to say they wanted it, I wanted it put under 4545, which is under trade practices. However, they wanted to put it under, Ledge Legal wanted to put it under Title 968 under miscellaneous provisions. So that's just something that I wanted you to make aware before I went through the sectional. The third issue that they brought up, it says, although the draft provides an individual with a cause of action against social media website, it is not clear that a court would have personal jurisdiction over social media website. As a result, the court might dismiss a case brought under this statute for lack of jurisdiction. And then the fourth issue was whether it belonged under deceptive trade practices, or miscellaneous provisions. So just wanted to make sure I got the Ledge Legal on there before I went over the sectional.
Okay. We'll see if we have any questions before we go to the next. Go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thanks. Can we get a copy of that memo from Ledge Legal about this bill?
We'll have it into the record. We'll make sure. Yep. Okay. Please proceed.
Okay, so section one, it's the short title, Stop Social Media Censorship Act. Section two is legislative findings. So legislative findings, it finds that the state legislature is opposed to censorship of online content unless the content is harmful to minors, promotes human trafficking. Number two, the legislature has a compelling interest in holding certain social media platforms to higher standards for having substantially created a digital public square. It also has an interest in helping residents, regardless of their religion or political affiliation, to enjoy their free exercise of certain semi-public forums for political and religious speech. It also, this is what, Mr. Chairman, you may be interested in, that the legislature finds that it has an interest in preventing social media platforms that have substantially created digital public square from malicious interference with state elections. I also wanted to add local and federal to that, so this bill definitely needs some work. Section 3, this is where I was talking about 096855 is where Ledge Legal wanted to put this provision in civil liabilities. And this is for censorship of speech by a platform. So, except it's provided G in this section, the owner or operator of a social media platform may not intentionally fact check, delete, use an algorithm, disfavor, shadow ban, or otherwise censorship political speech of a platform user. And basically, if they violate this section, a civil action may be brought by the injured platform user for actual damages, a penalty of not less than $75,000 for each violation, appropriate equitable relief, and then it states that a social media platform may mitigate these damages if it restores
a platform users deleted or censored religious or political speech within a reasonable time. And I just want to do a side note here. Today is the first day that someone sent me this where Facebook actually said, oh, we got it wrong, and they reinstated what they posted. So I thought that was very, very interesting. Next, a court may not accept the platform's use alleged hate speech as justification for social media platform to for delete or censor the platform's user for religious or political speech. And it also allows the Attorney General to bring civil action against the social media platform on behalf of the user. And then it tells the next area, it says it does not apply deletion or censorship of a platform's user if they do for, if they call for any violence, self-harm, pornography, operational error, court order, inauthentic source or impersonation, entices criminal conduct, is harmful to minors, involves bullying of minors. And then it goes into bullying, harassing behaviors on social media, which we all know exists out there, that a social media platform shall take steps to prevent bullying and harassing behaviors and shall provide platform user hosts with page mechanisms to establish and enforce rules of decorum to prevent bullying and harassing behavior. As you all know, we as elected officials deal with considerable amount at times, depending on how we vote on bills and things like that. And then it basically just, in this section, it defines what an algorithm means, what hate speech means, what a platform user is, what political speech is, what pornographic nature material religious means, what shadow ban means, what a social media platform is. So basically, as you all know, this is a new area of law, but it is something that we do need to discuss because it is definitely impacting our world around us.
Okay, thank you. I see there's no fiscal notes, so we won't, or zero fiscal notes. We'll go ahead and forego that one, but it's on the record. You had, I do see here we have Noah Klein. If we've got questions for him, like Senator Ramble said, and Kelly Toe. So there is also one invited testimony, I believe, you have online, which is Chris Schulte. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So do you have any questions for the sponsor this time, Senator Holland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill forward. And I think that where it speaks about protecting platform users' religious or political speech, I think it's meant in the very best way. But I just was curious where the definition of religious came from, because I believe I may not be religious, but I do belong to a religion. And to be a set of unproven faith-based assumptions or assertions that attempt to answer questions relating to how the world was created, what constitutes right and wrong, human action, what happens to humans after death, I'd hate to think that my religion was limited to that. And by putting that definition in here, does that only limit the protections to that? Because if I were to make a post on social media about my religious exemption, I don't believe it falls into any of that, and I would believe they could censor my speech because they didn't want me to talk. I just took a quick glance on the Internet, and I found relating to or manifesting faithful devotion to an acknowledged ultimate reality or deity as, I think, a better, more appropriate, broader, all-encompassing definition of religious.
Senator Holland, I agree with you fully. I did not come up with that definition. Noah Klein may be able to answer it, but I actually think that would be an awesome way to amend this bill, and I would be completely and fully open to that.
We'll just go to Noah. See, Noah, did you hear the question from Senator Holland? Do you have any comments on that?
Through the chair, to Senator Holland, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. Our office drafts bills according to the direction we receive from bill sponsors. And so the definition in the bill, we draft according to intent. So if you have a question about what the definition means or how it would be applied, I can try to answer that. But we draft as directed.
I'll probably submit that amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Holland. Senator Costello?
Thank you. And my comment also has to do with the same exact line, which is page 2, line 7. So this is preventing a platform user from being censored or deleted based off of
religious or political speech. And I'm wondering if all speech can be protected. So I'm just throwing this out there for consideration, and I'm willing to work with the sponsor. But where I'm thinking is we go with or otherwise censor speech of a platform user based on religious or political beliefs, race, sex, age, or identity choice. I think that perhaps, you know, all speech should be protected, and that no one should be punished. I guess, I mean, that's an interesting word to use, punished or deleted based off of anything. Unless, you know, and I like the section of the bill where it says, unless, you know, it's pornographic or it's the result of a, you know, it's harmful to kids. But I think that we should be protecting free speech and not allow anybody to be treated improperly because of their political views or their religious views or anything else. So I really appreciate this bill, Senator Reinbold.
Any comments? Probably not really that.
Just Mr. Chairman, I first of all want to talk about the religious thing. I didn't give them a specific definition. Somebody drafted this, so I really like your definition far better. And in regards to your view, I agree. And that's why, like I said, this is a new, it's an evolving area of law. That's why it's an uncodified law. And I looked into, and there's really no binding case law even in the state right now in regards to this at all. And so that's why I just wanted to bring it, because it's such a real issue. We all know that election years are coming up, and we know, you know, that a lot of us have been tremendously restricted. And I do think you have a really good point, all speech. However, I think we tried to put a little bit of parameters on it because they tended to be targeting politics and in some case religion. So, and with politics, political issues are so broad. They can almost be everything. So that's the only reason why there's probably a little bit of sidebars in there. But your question is very important, your issue, and I do think that it needs to be vetted. And I would love to bring more experts, to be honest with you, because I do think we need to get something, you know, into statute.
Okay, and just in the interest of, I know there's another question, but I would like to, as we are going to bring this bill back, so we'll have more chances for questions and follow up, and you can certainly ask the sponsor, but we've got one more bill to go through and then invite a testimony on House Bill 123 on tribal recognition, so I want to keep us going here, but Senator Kawasaki, I know you, are you okay? Okay. So that being said, we did have one invited testimony. I want to open up public testimony today on this as well. And we had, you said it was Chris?
Cameron.
Cameron, which I think, Cameron, you are online now. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you guys see and hear me?
I can hear you, Cameron. So when you're ready, please go ahead, if you would, put yourself on the record, name, who you represent, location, and if you would give us 3 minutes or less of public testimony, please begin.
I'll try to go fast. Thank you, Chairman Schauer, for holding a hearing on SB 214, allowing me to appear before the committee this evening. Thank you, Senator Reinbold, for introducing SB 214 and beginning the conversation there in the Frontier State. My name is Cameron Schulte. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Heartland Institute. For those that might not be familiar, we are a 38-year-old independent national nonprofit organization whose mission is to discover, develop, and promote free market solutions to social and economic problems. Heartland is headquartered in Illinois and focuses on providing national, state, and local elected officials with reliable and timely research and analysis on important policy issues. Mr. Chairman, I've already submitted testimony that you may have before you, so I don't want to go into rote recitation of that because that already gives you a good 35,000-foot overview of the issue. But I think what's important is to have a more organic conversation as the committee reviews this legislation. What I'd like to do is provide some context and nuance on this issue vis-a-vis what the issue is generally, and then how the various states are approaching it. And I'll come back to this in a moment. So you, as the committee wrestles with this issue, understand that 97% of social media traffic flows through just three firms. And it has become the de facto public square where political and religious issues are shared and debated. And frankly, sometimes those issues and that debate does indeed become ugly. And while it may be awful, it is still lawful. And while awful but lawful, it must surely be protected. our unalienable free speech rights are not subject to corporate capture. There are no shortages of examples where speech, particularly conservative speech, has been subject to censorious whims of big tech. Serendipitously, even, perhaps, is the revelation by the New York Times today that the Hunter Biden laptop story was indeed true. He is indeed under investigation, and it was not Russian disinformation. But when that story broke, a spokesperson for Facebook pointed out that while, quote, while I will not like to link to the New York Post, I want to be clear that this story is eligible to be fact-checked by Facebook's third-party fact-checking partners. In the meantime, we are reducing the distribution on our platform. Let me say that again. In the meantime, we are reducing its distribution on our platform. This is a, this issue isn't to rehash the 2020 election. That's not this issue. The issue is that government and big tech collude together to limit speech and viewpoint online in the de facto public square. This isn't an easy issue for conservatives or legislators of any ideological bend, really. At the Heartland Institute, we are unapologetically free market, and our instinct was to say that the solution to this challenge was market-based. But the fact remains, 97% of traffic goes through three big tech firms. You have competing interests in the Commerce Clause and the First Amendment. And with regards to the Commerce Clause, you have Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which allows states like Alaska to weigh in on this issue in the way SB 214 does. And you also have the First Amendment claims of big tech firms, whereas Section 230 of the 1996 CDA forbids lewd, lascivious, filthy, harassing, excessively violent, and otherwise objectionable content, the firms have exercised their discretion to prevent third-party content. But Section 230 requires a very narrow reading, and otherwise objectionable only refers to that which those first five don't capture. It is not, otherwise objectionable is not the whims of Silicon Valley.
And Cameron, and I do apologize, but if you could wrap it up for us.
I'm long-winded. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Do we have, looks like we do, Senator Costello?
Thank you very much. My question has to do with something the sponsor brought up at the beginning when she was introducing the bill. She mentioned that the legislative legal drafters put this in uncodified portion of our law, and her opinion was that it should go under Chapter 45 related to trade practices. And based on your experience and knowing what other states do you recommend that we do something like this in uncodified law or in the trade practices portion of our statute?
Mr. Chairman, through the chairman, Senator Costello, thank you for that question. This is an issue, I agree, this is an issue of consumer protection. Because what you have, generally speak, when you sign up for Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatever, you click, I agree, and that's considered a contract of adherence. And you effectively, people just click them and don't give it another thought. And what that does is then rolls or kind of sucks you into this world of community standards that the big tech firms tend to, for lack of a better way to describe it, they hide behind and use that as their shield to allow them to deplatform and to demonetize, etc. Now, with regards to specific Alaska statutes, I'm happy to look into that, but I think what Senator Reinbold is trying to do here in uncodified law, because this is, to her point, the Senator made a good point, was that this is an evolving section of law. And where you're dealing with viewpoint discrimination or religious discrimination, those issues are evolving at this very moment in other courts. to date, since January 21, almost 40 states have introduced some type of legislation, and I think the count is upwards of 80 bills have been introduced, and they've taken various forms, but in this case, this bill itself, SB 214, tends to deal with issues, and it says it in the opening, whereases, or the findings rather, that it tends to lean into the concept of common carriage. And so with that, it may be best in uncodified law, but that's probably a question to discuss with legislative counsel.
Okay. Just based on time, do we have any other questions? I'm not trying to rush you. We can also bring them back next time if you would like for follow-up. Okay. And so, Cameron, thanks for your time today. We may ask the sponsor to have you back if there's some follow-up questions, because it sounds like we probably could. I'm not trying to rush us too much. We just have some other folks I'd like to get to today that are standing by very patiently as well. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Do we have anybody in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 214? Seeing and hearing none. I don't see anybody online. Confirm with Alex. All right, so we have no public testimony or that's a new word available today. We're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 214. Making up words as I go. And at this point, just for the sponsor, do you have any closing arguments before, because we will bring it up again, of course.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to make sure that everybody has, I will make sure everyone gets this memo, and also I want to make sure that everyone sees the three pages of the Heartland Institute. There's some amazing information there. And yes, because it is a new emergency, I am not an expert by any way. I would really definitely like to bring him and potentially others, depending on the level of interest and questions that the committee has. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to set this bill aside. If anybody has amendments, if you get them to our office, I close the business next Monday, the 21st. I appreciate it. We'll bring the bill up at a future date. Okay, so I have a question here based on timing. I have some, we probably got about 15 minutes of invited testimony on House Bill 123 that they have been waiting in line. So I'm looking at Senator Myers, who has been waiting patiently as well. And I've got two questions here. The first one is, would the committee be willing to stay for a few minutes if our staff would after to let him intro his bill just to get an intro the first time?
Sure.
Okay. It won't take too long, but we'll go through it so we can get it forward. What I would like to do, though, because they've been waiting, is I would like to get our invited testimony for House Bill 123. Because they've been very patient, and I want to get them done and let them have the questions answered. So if that's okay, we'll do it in that order, and that way Senator Myers can finish up with what we have, and then we will, of course, bring the bill back up. I do want to ask the question, though, of our staff, Carrie and Alex, is it okay for a few minutes past five? Okay, and I've asked him multiple times before, but we have one of the highest caseloads besides finance and labor and commerce, so I'm trying to get to them. That being said, we're going to move forward a bit to House Bill 123. We have invited testimony online today from multiples, and we're going to get to that point. And we have the Assistant Attorney General from the Department of Law, Laura Wolf. We have Betty Jo Moore with us today, and Julie Kitka, all of who, like I said, have been very patient. So I believe, just so that I have it right, what first one we're going to do is the Department of Law. Is that correct? Okay, and they're going to brief to House Bill 123 and the issues we've been investigating, trying to run trap lines to make sure we've looked at this from every possible angle and get everything out into the public so that all of the questions and concerns have been answered. So we're going to start with you, Laura. If you could put yourself on the record, name who you represent, your location, please, and then I know we've prepared you, or staff has prepared you with testimony, so when you're ready, please begin.
For the record, this is Assistant Attorney General Laura Wolf speaking in Anchorage through the chair. The Department of Law was asked to assess whether the text of House Bill 123 in any way impacts the powers or authorities of tribes or of the state. Our conclusion that it does not in any way change or confer new rights or authority. I'm available for any questions as it pertains to the memo the department sent the committee regarding the bill.
Okay, so at this time, pretty straight answer.
How are y'all doing?
Oh, boy. That might be our Irish guy. Hold on a minute. If he's there, if that's him, can you hold on, sir? Because our time kind of ran out. I thought you weren't going to make it, so we're going to ask you to hold on for just a second because we have some testifiers here, and I know that was, if that's okay.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Yeah, if it's okay, while we've got Laura, and this was a little bit unusual, folks, today, it's St. Patrick's Day, we're trying to do something kind of cool and different. If Laura, Betty Jo, and Julie, if you guys, we're going to get you in here in a minute for the testimony, and we're going to ask the Senate President of the Irish Senate on St. Patrick's Day, if he could, 3 minutes of how you doing with language that we may not understand because of the accent, say hi, and if you could do 3 minutes or less, sir, we do appreciate it, and we do appreciate you calling in to Senate State Affairs in Alaska. Go ahead.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate you. I'm sorry I'm late. We were celebrating St. Patrick's Day, so I'm here on Irish time. So I'm only showing up a bit late, like an hour or so. But really appreciate you celebrating St. Patrick's Day, and I want to make sure that you all come to Ireland either this year for the 100th anniversary of our Senate or next year for the American Irish State Legislators Caucus that are coming together for the Notre Dame Navy game. I don't know whether you pray for Notre Dame and cheer for Navy.
Senator, I just want to say it's a real honor to be one of the co-chairs of the Friends of Ireland caucus here in the Alaska Legislature, along with Representative Ivy Swanholtzen. I want to congratulate you on being able to establish Friends of Ireland caucuses in all 50 states, and we certainly would love to have you in Alaska. So thank you for coming before our committee today.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and sorry, we can't, you know, when you're doing virtually, they're not great, but I can tell you, drinking virtually is not much fun either, so I hope after you have your meeting that you celebrate St. Patrick's Day appropriately, and I know that you got the St. Patrick's Day box with the lapel pins and the certificates and the flag flown from the building where the first Irish flag was flown by a man who ended up as governor of Montana. So next year is his 200th birthday. So we hope that he'll come to Ireland either this year or next year. And we'll make sure that instead of drinking virtually and meeting virtually, we'll celebrate in person.
Senator, thanks for calling in. We really appreciate the time. I will say my wife and I, when I was stationed in England flying F-15s, we spent St. Patrick's Day 1998 in Dublin. And if I never see another Guinness beer as long as I live, that will be too soon for me.
we'll try and get you better beer. And remember, when you come visit our parliament, there are two bars in the parliament. So that's how we get the work done over in our end of the world. We just, you know the way they say you have to grease the wheels? In Ireland, we more oil the wheels rather than grease them.
Thanks for the call, Senator. Appreciate you taking your time. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Happy Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Bye-bye. A little bit of a break there, folks. A little unusual, but I hope that was at least amusing. It certainly was for me. Okay, so we're going to continue back with Laura in case there's any questions for the assessment of the Attorney General. Does anyone have questions on their assessment for House Bill 123? Okay, and I just I'm going to hold off the questions. We'll ask these written so everybody can see them because I've had some more for time. We're going to go on to two here. We've got both Betty Jo and Julie that we're going to give about 5 minutes or so of testimony each. So we're just going to start with Betty Jo because it's top of the list here. So Betty Jo, please put yourself on the record with name, who you represent, location, and then 5 minutes or less, please.
Okay. Can everyone hear me?
Loud and clear. Please continue.
Okay. The senators and representatives, my name is Betty Jo, and I'm a private citizen. I am a tribal citizen, and I'm opposing HB 123 for the following reasons. Page 2, the jurisdiction of the state over a person. Number 2, jurisdiction over forming part of the boundaries of the state. 3, legislative jurisdiction of the United States over an area to which legislative jurisdiction ceded by the state and that which remains in the ownership of the United States. All of this is very confusing. In 1953, Congress enacted Public Law 280. In 1958, Alaska was made a mandatory PL 280 state. For Alaska, all Indian country is within the state except that on the Net Island, Metlakatla. PL-280 is a federal statute that transferred jurisdiction over all criminal matters committed by or against Indians in Indian Country from the federal government to the state. May 29, 2019, Alaska Public Media by Wesley Early reported that many leaders often found it hard to qualify for federal resources because of legal confusion between federal Indian Country laws and the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. October 17, 2019, press release, Senator Murkowski, Alaska Tribal Public Safety Empowerment Act, empowers Alaska Natives to obtain protection under the Special Domestic Violence Criminal Jurisdiction. Senator Murkowski's bill recognizes the specific jurisdictional complexities that tribes in Alaska face. What are the specific jurisdictional complexities? State of Alaska Attorney General Michael Garrity, in the case regarding a small tribal court in the village of Minchell, the state intervened on Mr. Park's side to protect his constitutional rights. Attorney General Garrity said, "We're supporting his due process rights as we would any other Alaskan." That was in the Anchorage Daily News, 8/25/2013. The state of Alaska's attorney general is the roadmap that ensures protection of all Alaskans' U.S. constitutional rights. The U.S. attorney general is the roadmap that ensures protection of Alaskans' U.S. constitutional rights. Federal attorney general and state attorney general have jurisdiction over criminal matters in Alaska and protection of our constitutional rights. As a former tribal judge, I have seen that within tribal government, not all tribal citizens' U.S. constitutional rights are protected. Is there comity between tribal governments? No. Is there? There is no comity. Is there comity between tribal courts and state of Alaska jurisdiction? Does a tribal citizen have the same rights within tribal court as within a state court? Comity. Where is the comity? Comity should be nation to nation before it is nation to state. HB 123 is not the answer to improving lives for all Alaskans, not the answer to curbing or stopping domestic violence, not the answer to curbing or stopping sex trafficking, etc. How much of the $7.5 million was used for law enforcement to small villages in Alaska when Attorney General Barr made his visit and gave money in 2019. Because Alaska is a PL-280 state, the federal government transferred jurisdiction over all criminal matters committed by or against Indians in Indian Country from the federal government to the state of Alaska. Alaskans must be kept from criminal acts within the state of Alaska and their constitutional rights protected. Are tribal governments and tribal courts funded properly by the federal government at this time? How many millions is the state going to provide to Alaska tribes? If HB 123 passes, it is only the beginning of the state having to address ongoing further issues surrounding Alaska Native people and Alaska jurisdiction. HB 123, as written on a couple pages, does not protect or benefit all Alaskan Natives or non-Natives within a tribal government setting. Please do not pass HB 123 as written. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction of this bill and for time to speak.
Okay. Thank you, Betty Jo, especially for keeping it to 5 minutes. What I'd like to do for time, I know there's a question. We're going to hold it till Julie, who's been very, very patient. Thank you, Julie. Last on this word today, but certainly not least, when you're ready, you know the drill. Please put yourself on the record, name who you represent, location, and I'd ask for 5 minutes or less as well. So you have the floor, Julie, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Julie Kitka, and I have the honor of serving as the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I apologize. I'm calling in via phone because I'm out of the state for obligation I had here in Nebraska. I wanted to, again, clarify for the record, we have shared different information with the committee that we want to put on the record. One is the document Alaska's Unique Forms of Native Self-Determination and Tribal Self-Governance. That document we prepared to try to give examples of what's different in Alaska versus the rest of the United States. Also had a document, a summary briefing for the Senate State Affairs Committee, further information on state recognition of tribes, and basically reiterating that the implication of state recognition of tribes in Alaska is different. Alaska's tribes already have federal recognition status, so the impact of House Bill 123 is primarily one of respect, starting to build trust and opening up potentials for cooperation and coordination on the many issues affecting Alaskans. Again, this bill does not affect the federal trust responsibility, does not affect the federal tribal recognition. It does not affect the sovereignty of federally recognized tribes, does not impact the federal recognition process, and will have no bearing on state taxation of Alaska Native lands. Lastly, as I testified before, state recognition is further a matter of state law. It varies both in terms of the mechanism and the scope. In the memo that we provided you, we gave you examples of further information on state recognition of tribes, that it varies. Many of the states utilizing state recognition of tribes are in the eastern states, including the three largest state-recognized tribes in the U.S., the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, the Miami Nation of Indiana, and the United Houma Nation of Louisiana. And then we described what is a state-recognized tribe, again, knowing that that's distinct from a federally recognized tribe, but why people were doing federal tribal state recognition versus the federal recognition process. As currently, our research has shown there's over 100 applications still pending in the federal recognition process before the official Federal Office for Tribal Recognition within the Department of Interior. Very few applications are processed every year, with only 1 to 2 processed in recent years. So what you have in other parts of the country is a desire to get the recognition through the state process. Many of them may be still trying to do it under the federal recognition process. In Alaska, it's completely different because all our tribes are already federally recognized. It is just a matter of the state recognizing what's already the case. So I just wanted to reiterate for the committee, we stand by to answer any questions or provide answers in writing if that's something that's helpful. This isn't a jurisdictional bill. And people often think that jurisdiction and recognition are the same, and they're not. And the issue of Indian country was determined by the Benintai case. You do have Indian country with the Metlakatla Indian Reservation, as well as allotments on that. But other than that, the Benintai case controls this. If the legislature adopts this House Bill 123, it doesn't overturn any court cases. So that's it, Mr. Chairman. Glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Julie, for that and being a little bit under the 5 minutes. So that being said, with the respect for time and the where we sit for today's purposes, if we could keep questions short and answers short, I know Senator Reinbold had one for one of the presenters.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you both for being here. You bring unique perspectives. And so I don't really care which one of you answer this. I'm going to save my question about Section 3 and 4 of the bill because I have a lot of questions on Section 3 and 4 of the bill, but I'm just going to ask one simple question. Do we really have 229 sovereign nation tribes, and how do you basically recognize a tribal member? So is there 229 different types of tribes, and how would, is that a bloodline, I guess is what I'm trying to figure out, or how does somebody become a tribal member?
I'd like to go ahead and answer that if you'd like. Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinbold, one thing that's unique on federal Indian law in regard to tribes and tribal membership is that is the sole prerogative of the tribe themselves to set up their membership. and they will have different qualifications and requirements that they have. You may have some that have blood quantum. You may have some that are residency-based. It's considered an internal domestic issue to the tribe, and they would set that up themselves. Thank you.
Through the chair. So basically what I'm hearing, and I want to make sure I'm hearing this properly, is basically you all get to select your members. And so what my question would be is I would like to see the 229, and even if we get a handful of them, of how they select their members, because I didn't realize this until a pretty prominent leader came into my office recently, and I learned that they get to select their own members. I didn't know that. I made an assumption that it was a specific, you know, bloodline. So I'm definitely very interested in this. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I see Betty Jo, you had your hand up. If you'd like to give us an answer as well.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, it described that a native means a citizen of the United States who is a person of 1/4 degree or more Alaska Indian, including Tsimshian Indians not enrolled in Metlakatla Indian Community, Eskimo or Aleut blood, or combination thereof. The term includes any native as so defined, either or both of those of whose adoptive parents are not natives. So it goes on to define it, and number one, I'm a U.S. citizen, and number two, I have to have at least 1/4 degree or more of Alaska Native, and that's how it was defined for the Alaska Native Settlements Act. And this is the thing, as down in the enrollment process does change from tribe to tribe within 229. Some may be the same and some may not. There's no consistency. And so, thank you.
Through the chair, Ms. Julie Kika, could you please tell me if you agree or disagree that a tribal member must be at least 1/4, and I believe I tried to write this down as fast as I could, Indian, Eskimo, Aleut, Athabascan, and be a U.S. citizen. Is that how you would describe a tribal member?
Through the chair, no, that's incorrect. That is the definition that's in the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act for enrolling to be part of the land claim settlement. Tribal membership is completely different than ANCSCA enrolled shareholder member. Under federal Indian law, tribes are allowed to set their own membership requirements. There are tribes that have members that are dual citizens of Alaska and Canada. They have members that are descendancy roles that you just have to prove your tie to one ancestor that was on a census roll that was important to your tribe. That's internal tribal issues, and the tribes are entitled to set that up themselves. There is no requirement for citizenship. There's no requirement for 1/4 degree. No requirement you be enrolled in the land claims. They have their own membership. And like I said, it varies across the state. And the tribe also has the ability to change their membership and add people or remove people based on their own decisions on that. And again, probably the most significant difference in tribal memberships in Alaska are those that are residency-based versus those that are not. So if you take, for example, Tlingit Haida Central Council, which is the largest federally recognized tribe in Alaska, they do not have a residency-based requirement for membership, and I believe that their membership is now up to about 34,000 Alaska Native that are members of that. For some of the smaller tribes, they would be smaller in numbers, but maybe they'll put a residency. You're living in that community, but if you move out of there, you possibly lose your right to vote in the tribe or even are not eligible for membership. But again, federal Indian law allows the tribes to set up their own membership and their own requirements because it's a domestic issue. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think you answered my question, but
The answer is no, you don't have to have a bloodline to become a tribal member. This is just a big deal. For 229 tribes sounds like a lot to me. I'm absolutely not an expert in this area, but it sounds like there's a lot of basically you guys get to develop your own tribes, and it could be a very broad or a very narrow and definition. So I was just always under the pressure that it had to be a bloodline. So this opens a much broader issue in my opinion. If you guys can kind of pick and choose, you know, who your tribal members are, this is a big deal. So it sounds like yes, you can pick and choose your tribal members, correct?
And Julie and Betty Jo, what I'm going to ask you guys to do here, because of time, this keeps going on, and I need to stop this for the next one. I'm going to encourage Senator Reinbold and everybody else to call you directly or email and ask those questions and get answers from you, because these are why we're running these to ground, to make sure everybody's concerns are assuaged or put in amendments if they think it needs to be, and that's totally fine. Not going to rush it. This is a big one, and I understand we want to get it right. So I would ask everybody, and of course, if we could pull it up again and have you guys back with a little more time as well. Totally open to how we want to play that, but I would ask committee members, please get with them for now and try to get those questions answered, and we will bring them back to have a further discussion just so that it's on the record as well. So I will leave it up to you guys to talk to that, or we can come back. That's fine, but I do need to keep moving on this one. So, ladies, thank you very much for your time. We'll be in touch with you via email and perhaps phone calls or a follow-up. And at this time, we're going to move on to the last one, and we're going to make it quick because I did promise I'm getting him up here for this one. We're going to have Senator Myers come up and do a quick presentation intro on Senate Bill 129, and then we will bring the bill back up at a later time. So you might want to hold your questions so we can all be done. So, Senator Myers, when you're ready, on the record, and bring Senate Bill 129, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll try to keep it brief. For the record, Robert Myers, Senator for District B. I'd like to speak real quick to the intent and of the bill, and then I'll turn it over to my staff for a little bit more of the technical questions. So first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to bring the bill forward before you. What we're attempting to do is to illuminate part of our election process that is often overlooked. In most circumstances, judges are not allowed to run campaigns in retention elections, and by the nature of their work, they often try to stay out of the public eye, which I can completely understand. But the result of that is that most people don't know who they're voting for when they walk into the election booth, and that can sometimes then result in a lack of trust in the system. So what we're trying to do is ask that some information that the Judicial Council already collects be published in the official election pamphlet that the Division of Elections sends out every September or so. And we hope that by doing that, we can both increase turnout and increase some trust in the system. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my staff here.
Good afternoon, Senator Chair Schauer and members of the State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Woltstead, and I'm going to be going over the bill relatively quickly, especially the PowerPoint presentation. So just to kind of get into it for sake of brevity. So looking over, the State of Alaska constitutional framers established a three-part judicial merit system and retention program. And we're going to be focusing specifically for the third phase of the merit system that really focuses on retention elections in the State of Alaska, in which judges periodically appear on the ballot to allow voters to decide whether the judges should continue in office. So CS for SB 129 focuses on the critical third phase of the constitutional framers' belief that the judiciary has to maintain accountability to the electorate. And the election pamphlet for the judicial officers is comprised of two sections. One is submitted by the judicial officer seeking retention. You'll see that the first page here. And then you'll also see the second page, which is developed as an evaluation of the judicial officers by the Judicial Council. So the Judicial Council conducts an extensive performance evaluation, interviews, public hearings, and surveys to assist the judicial officers, and then also make recommendations to the voters either to retain or not retain the judge. In addition to that, they also provide all this wealth of information that they do collect actually on their website, and they do put that on the election ballot. You can see it at the bottom of the page here at the very bottom. That's one of the sections that they do put that on the website. So judicial officers standing for retention must receive a simple majority of votes, so we're looking at the 50% cutoff. And you can see over the past time frames, there is a little bit of an interesting dichotomy of retention for when they do recommend no. Sometimes we do have retention votes to keep them in, and it sometimes takes two shots in the elections to not retain them. So this is a little bit of the data. But given brevity, we'll move on forward. So the success of the Judicial Merit Program really is focused on providing the electorate information to make these informed decisions. Getting over to eight. So the first section of the election pamphlet is going to be submitted by the judge that is seeking retention. So what we're looking at for the bill itself is clarifying some of that information that the judge may actually submit. So this is all voluntary that they can actually submit. The photographs that they can, we have information regarding residency of the judge, military service, professional activities, public outreach and administrative activities, additional information that the judge would like to publish in support of their judicial candidacy as well. So the next section deals with the pamphlet area that is being submitted by the Judicial Council. So the second section is going to be focusing more on additional information that a judge may provide and get to the superior court judges and district court judges. So what we're looking at right here is just a quick list, and I apologize for the text, but first focusing on a statement of written by the judge describing their professional philosophy, judicial, legal, or other education, business experience or professional positions held in the preceding 10 years, affiliated service with organizations, and if applicable, rating by law enforcement officers, attorneys, court employees, and jurors. Then we're also looking at number of decisions that were reviewed and disposed by a written decision of the appellate court, and then the percentage of the issues of those decisions that were affirmed by the appellate court. Then a description of any public disciplinary procedures that are against the judge or justice at that time, and then a self-assessment evaluating the individual judge's performance. So we have a quick separation out between the different levels of the court system. So this is for the Supreme Court justices or courts of the appellate court judges, and this is requiring pretty much the same information for the superior and district court judges, except the number of the decisions that were reviewed and disposed and the percentage of issues in those decisions that were affirmed due to the application of those informations for that level. As you can imagine, there's not that much of an application rate for looking at affirmations for courts at the Supreme Court level. So we're providing some of this information. Then the next one is actually focusing on those who are standing for retention for the first time. So for these individuals that are first coming into the system, we're adding an additional section, and that's previous political and government positions held by the justice or judge, including political offices, then the judge's primary practices before the appointment, percentages of the justice or judge's pre-appointment career as spent as a trial lawyer, and then type of clients the judge or justice is represented before the appointment system. So we do have a little bit of the ward limits that we added into this section as well, and that was mostly to make sure that we maintain the election pamphlet to the two pages. And that, again, is just to make sure with the aspects to provide the, I guess one way of saying it, is just to make sure that the election pamphlet is not 400 to even larger scale. So that is one of the areas that we're establishing, like a 1,200-word limit for information provided by the Judicial Council. Now, I know that was very fast, but given the time, I wanted to make that as brief as possible.
Thank you very much. And I was just curious, do judges have to file their personal financial information, you know, the amount of money they own on a home, or if they have dependent children, to the Alaska Public Offices Commission?
Through the Chair, Senator Costello, yes, judges do file the same basically the same APOC requirements that we have as elected officials. Mm-hmm. The difference is that our information is publicly available on APOC's website, mm-hmm. whereas for judges, it has to be specifically requested per judge from APOC in order to get that information.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see any other questions this time because I'm sure everybody doesn't want to ask them at this point. So, Senator Myers, thanks for that. We are going to bring it back up, of course. I am going to open up, because we said we would, and I don't think we have any, but we'll get it on the record, open up public testimony on Senate Bill 129. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I don't see anybody online. Can't see them. I'll just ask. Alex, anybody? Okay, thank you. Seeing and hearing none online, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on Senate Bill 129. We'll get that done. This time, if there's any amendments from committee members, if they could have them to our office by next Monday, the 21st, I would appreciate it, and then we'll bring the bill back up to work on that, and I would encourage you to ask questions of the sponsor directly. That being said, with a lot of appreciation to everybody today for staying late, including staff, we'll conclude our business for today. We'll be meeting again back in this room next week at 3:30 on Tuesday. And seeing no other business, we're going to gavel out late with much appreciation at 5:20.